Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Have you ever noticed how men and women often experience diseases so differently? I mean, it's not just about how common a condition might be, but also how severe it gets, or even, you know, when it first shows up. Think about something as fundamental as blood pressure, or how fat is distributed in our bodies. These can vary pretty significantly between the sexes. Have you ever wondered if these differences are purely environmental, or maybe if there's a deeper genetic story at play? Right down to the very specific locations on our DNA. Imagine if a health recommendation designed for everyone was actually, well, less effective or maybe even counterproductive for half the population, all because we missed crucial genetic details hiding in plain sight. How could understanding these subtle, localized genetic nuances change how we approach health for everyone? That's exactly what we're diving into today. Today, we celebrate the groundbreaking work of Emil Offelman, Christian Delu, Maureen Schipper, and Danielle Postuma. They're primarily from the Department of Complex Trait Genetics, Center for Neurogenomics and Cognitive Research at Rijksuniversiteit Amsterdam. Their research significantly advances our understanding of local genetic sex differences in quantitative traits.
Yeah, the core scientific problem here is pretty clear. Males and females exhibit distinct patterns in disease. We see differences in prevalence, severity, even when diseases first appear. And beyond that, many quantitative traits, things like height, weight, various blood counts, they're sexually dimorphic, which just means they show different average values and variances between the sexes. Now, these observed differences, they aren't just one-dimensional. They could stem from environmental factors, right? Like societal norms or lifestyle. But they can also be driven by internal biological differences. Think varying hormone levels or gene expression patterns. And crucially, sex itself can act almost like an environmental variable interacting with our genetic variants. This is what we call gene-by-sex interaction, or GXS. And it can create these, well, partially distinct traits in males and females.
Okay, and this is where traditional genetic studies often hit a bit of a wall, isn't it? These big genome-wide association studies, GOAs, they usually analyze males and females together, often just, you know, accounting for sex as a background variable. And while this approach has given us incredible insights, no doubt it might be inadvertently masking some truly sex-specific genetic effects, effects that are maybe unique to one sex or just different and completely missed by that combined analysis.
Exactly. Even when we look at global analyses, things like heritability across the whole genome or overall genetic correlations between sexes, even when those find some differences, they simply can't pinpoint the local architecture. Specifics. For instance, if a gene shows a strong association in men, say, but just misses the statistical significance threshold in women, it's not really enough to declare a true biological difference. The crucial question becomes, what's actually happening at those specific genetic locations, those individual loci?
That's a really vital distinction. And what's interesting is that recent research seems to suggest these gene-by-sex interactions mostly act through differences in the magnitude of the genetic effects, rather than completely different sets of causal variants. But here's an important clarification that this new study really brings home. The scale we use to measure these effect sizes, it matters a lot, especially for interpreting things like heritability. We're talking about the raw scale versus a standardized scale.
And that's precisely where this new study steps in to bridge those gaps, to get a deeper, more granular understanding of these localized genetic similarities and, well, dissimilarities. This research moves beyond those global averages. They do this by estimating local genetic correlations, comparing local heritability estimates, and rigorously testing for the equality of genetic effects. And they look at this at both regional levels, roughly 1 megabase chunks of the genome, and even down to the individual gene level, across a really impressive 157 quantitative traits.
Wow, 157 traits. And to do this, they use sex-stratified GWO summary statistics from the UK Biobank, right? Which is an enormous data set, covering all those traits, with a maximum sample size of over 360,000 individuals, British ancestry mostly. And it's worth mentioning, I think, that the UK Biobank dataset actually has a slight female sampling bias. The median female-to-male ratio was about 1.1 Steen in the data they used.
Correct. And the key technology that enables this kind of granular analysis is called LEA, stands for Local Analysis of Variants. LEA essentially chops up the autosomal genome into 2,495 semi-independent loci. Semi-LD independent, technically. Each of these loci is about 1 megabase in size, so it allows for a highly localized look at genetic effects. It's like zooming way in on specific neighborhoods of our DNA.
Okay, LVA. So what kind of tests did LVA run in this study?
Mainly three key tests. First, it calculated local heritability, or H2 local. That measures the genetic contribution to a trait within those specific genomic regions. Second, it estimated local genetic correlations, RG, local. This basically asks how genetically similar a trait is between males and females at that specific spot. And finally, they used an equality of genetic effects test. Now, this one's a bit more specific, more stringent. It looks for differences in genetic architecture, considering both the direction and the magnitude of effects. And critically, it does this on two distinct scales. The raw scale, looking at effects on the natural scale of the phenotype, like millimeters of mercury for blood pressure, and the standardized scale, where effect sizes are scaled by the standard deviation of the phenotype in that sex.
Right. Those two scales, again, raw versus standardized.
Yeah.
Why the need for both? What's the core difference in what they tell us?
It's a really crucial distinction for interpretation. Think of it like this. The raw scale tells us about the absolute genetic effect, the direct impact on the trait as it's measured, you know. The standardized scale, on the other hand, tells us about the relative genetic contribution. How much does genetics account for the overall variability of that trait within that specific sex?
Okay.
So if genetic effects differ on the raw scale but not on the standardized scale, it means the absolute genetic influence is different, but its relative contribution to the trait's total variation is actually the same between sexes.
I see.
Conversely, if standardized effects differ but the raw effects don't, then both the absolute and the relative genetic contributions are different. Both scales give us really important complementary insights into the underlying biology.
Got it. That makes sense. And to try and figure out which specific genes might be driving these differences within those regions, they also use something called FLAMES.
Yes, FLAMES. It's a gene prioritization tool. It helps predict the most likely causal genes within those loci that showed interesting patterns.
Okay, so let's get to the findings. What did they actually discover after all this detailed local analysis? Well, here's the headline finding, and it's pretty striking. While the vast majority of loci across the genome don't show significant differences between sexes, it turns out that nearly every single trait they studied, almost all 157, showed evidence for sex dimorphic effects in at least one specific locus. That suggests these hidden genetic differences are far more pervasive than those global averages would lead us to believe, potentially affecting how we understand health in males and females quite profoundly.
Indeed. It's quite something. Looking first at local heritability differences, they pinpointed 146 loci across 47 different traits that showed significant sex differences in their local heritability estimates. And interestingly, about 62% of these significant local heritabilities were found in only one sex, not both. Overall, more loci with significant local heritability were found in females over 10,600 compared to males, who had around 8,700. Now, this is partly explained by the larger female sample size in UK Biobank, but the sheer prevalence of sex-specific heritability at the local level is still remarkable.
Were there some standout examples?
Yeah, definitely. For testosterone, one locus, locus 2181, had a local heritability of 4.3% in males. Pretty substantial for one locus, but in females, a tiny 0.06%. That's a massive difference in genetic contribution right there for a key sex hormone.
Wow.
For rheumatoid factor, locus 963 showed a local heritability of 1% in females, but only 0.02% in males. Again, quite different. And for urate levels in the blood, they found four neighboring loci where the female heritability estimates were consistently 4 to 5 times larger than the male estimates. We're talking ranges like 0.5% to 10% in females versus 0.1% to 2.7% in males for those loci. This strongly implicates the SLC2A9 gene, suggesting it plays a much bigger relative role in urate levels in females, at least genetically speaking.
Okay, so heritability can differ quite a bit locally. What about the genetic similarity of the trait itself between sexes at these specific locations? How did the local genetic correlations pan out?
That was another really fascinating area. They found that 118 traits had at least one locus where the local genetic correlation between sexes was significantly different from one, meaning the genetic effects weren't perfectly correlated at that spot. And maybe even more surprising, 205 loci across 103 traits actually had negative local genetic correlation.
Negative, meaning opposite effects.
Exactly, implying that the genetic effects at those specific locations were potentially acting in opposite directions between males and females. Think about that. What's genetically beneficial for one sex could potentially be detrimental for the other at the very same genetic locus. That's a profound finding.
Absolutely. Which traits showed these kinds of differences most often?
Blood biomarker traits seem to stand out. Things related to metabolism, immunology, IGF-1 and testosterone, again, had the largest number of such differing loci. But here's a particularly striking insight. Many traits that have a global genetic correlation really close to one suggesting high similarity overall, like body mass index, BMI. Its global ergood was 0.93, very high. Yet even BMI contained individual loci where the local genetic correlation strongly diverged from one. For instance, BMI locus 1727 had a local genetic correlation of negative 0.12.
Minus 0.12. Wow.
Yeah. So a global all clear on genetic similarity can totally obscure these crucial local divergences.
That really highlights the limitation of only looking globally.
It does. And then you have the counterexample, testosterone. Its global genetic correlation was near zero, suggesting very little overall genetic overlap between the sexes for this trait. Yet when you look locally, it displayed several loci with both strong positive and strong negative local genetic correlations. For example, locus 2020 had a local org of negative 0.67, while locus 963 showed a positive 0.85. It just underscores how global averages can paint a misleadingly simple picture. The local view reveals a much more complex sex-specific genetic landscape. Different variants matter in different ways for each sex, even for the same trait.
It really does sound like we're shifting from a blurry satellite image to a high-definition street view of our genetics here. So what happened when they drilled down even further with those equality of genetic effects tests, the ones looking at both the raw and standardized scales?
Right. This specific test gives us perhaps the most nuanced understanding of these sex differences. Yeah. Out of the 157 traits studied, somewhere between 151 and 152 of them had at least one locus that showed a significant difference between sexes on either the raw or the standardized scale. Almost all of them.
Okay, let's break that down with some examples. How did the raw versus standardized comparison play out?
Let's take sex hormone binding globulin, or SHBG. Some genes like NRBF2, JMJD1C, and REEP3 showed really strong differences on the standardized scale, but not the raw scale.
Right.
Why? It was because females in the study had 3.6 times larger phenotypic variance for SHBG. The overall spread of SHBG levels was much wider in females. So what this means is that while the absolute genetic effect of these genes on SHBG levels might have been similar between sexes, its relative contribution to the trait's total variation was very different. This led to the local heritability being more than 3 times larger in males for these genes, about 1.1% in males versus only 0.3% in females.
Ah, so the gene had a bigger relative impact in males because the overall non-genetic variation was smaller in males.
Precisely. It indicates a stronger genetic effect in males relative to the phenotype's overall variability in males.
Interesting. What about the other way around? Differences on the raw scale, but not standardized.
Good question. For high-density lipoprotein, or HDL, the CETP gene showed strong differences on the raw scale, but not the standardized scale. In this case, the local heritabilities are actually pretty similar. 4.6% in females versus 4.3% in males. Not a huge difference there. However, females had 1.5 times larger phenotypic variance for HDL. So here, the absolute genetic effect was different between sexes, but its relative contribution to the trait's overall variability was quite similar.
So the distinction between those scales is really critical for understanding why the genetic effect appears different.
Absolutely vital. It tells you whether the difference is in the direct genetic push or in how much that push matters relative to everything else affecting the trait in that sex. And here's where it gets particularly fascinating, I think. Testosterone and the AKR1C3 gene region. They found an overlapping GW is hit for both sexes in this region, but the lead SMPs, the most associated genetic variants, were actually different and located on opposite sides of the AKR1C3 gene itself.
Oh, wow. So same gene region, different signals.
Exactly. And both the raw and standardized equality tests showed significant differences associated with this gene. And the FLAMES tool even predicted different causal genes might be at play within this locus, AKR1C2 maybe for females, and AKR1C4 maybe for males. So even when the general region is implicated in both sexes, the specific pattern of SNP associations and potentially the actual causal gene can be markedly different. It implies really distinct underlying genetic mechanisms.
That's incredible. Any other examples?
Yeah, a couple more worth mentioning. For diastolic blood pressure, the study replicated a previous finding that the CO4A1, COL4A2 locus is sexual dimorphic. It was significant in the male GWAs, but not the female one. And their analysis flagged CO4A1 specifically as differing the most on both scales and predicted it as the likely causal gene, but mainly for males. Helps pinpoint why this locus might matter more for male blood pressure. And finally, low-density lipoprotein, or LDL. The famous APOE gene showed really pronounced sex differences on both raw and standardized equality tests. Its local heritability was actually twice as large in females, 6%, compared to males, where it was 3%.
Despite the correlation being high.
Exactly. This was despite the local genetic correlation for this APOE locus being very close to 1, at 0.996. So the pattern of AVEX was similar, but the magnitude of the genetic contribution to LDL variability seems substantially greater in females at this specific critical locus. And they found similar patterns involving APOE for HDL, apolipoprotein B, and total cholesterol too. Suggests really key sex-specific genetic influences on lipid metabolism centered around APOE.
So stepping back, what are the big implications of all these findings?
Well, fundamentally, this deep dive really hammers home how those average global metrics, overall genetic correlation, genome-wide heritability, can effectively mask incredibly important variability between individual loci. It means that what might look like a uniform genetic landscape from, 30,000 feet is actually a highly varied terrain when you get down to the local level.
Right. The averages hide the interesting details.
Precisely. It also underscores the critical importance of considering the scale of genetic effects raw versus standardized. They really do offer complementary interpretations. They help us disentangle differences in just the phenotypic variance from true differences in heritability or differences in the absolute genetic effect size. And these localized sex differences, they act like powerful flags. They point towards potentially crucial biological distinctions between sexes for all sorts of traits, even for things like BMI, where the global differences look minimal.
How might this connect to broader biological insights or disease?
Well, take the APOE example again. The findings strongly suggest that ATOE must interact differently with male or female-specific factors, maybe hormones, maybe environment like diet, to lead to such divergent genetic effect sizes, especially for LDL. This could be a key mechanism mediating the known sex dimorphic effects of APOE on diseases like Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease, where APOE is a major risk factor with known sex differences in risk.
That makes sense.
And the AKR1C example for testosterone, where different genes might be causal in the same region, it shows that even when GLA hits overlap spatially, the underlying genetic architecture can be fundamentally distinct. It's almost as if testosterone, genetically speaking, acts like two partially separate phenotypes in males and females at those specific locations.
That's a fascinating way to put it. So if the genetic region is shared, why might different causal genes be predicted locally for males versus females? What did the researchers suggest?
They touched on a few possibilities. One, you could have strong gene-bisex interactions making the effects qualitatively different, essentially different mechanisms. Two, a locus might simply contain multiple causal genes and their relative importance just differs by sex. Three, maybe the locus only reached statistical significance in one sex, so you wouldn't get a prediction for the other. And finally, we have to remember there's always some uncertainty in these gene prioritization tools like FLAMES. They mentioned about 75% precision, which is good, but not perfect.
Okay. And like all studies, this one must have had some limitations too.
Of course. First, Elavier works with these 1 megabase loci. These regions can contain multiple genes. So whether the genetic correlation or heritability estimate applies uniformly across that entire block or is driven by just one part isn't fully known from this analysis alone. Sublocus consistency is an open question. Second, this study focused on quantitative traits. Applying these methods robustly to binary traits, like disease presence-absence, is apparently still ongoing work. And third, and this is important, it relied solely on UK Biobank data.
Right, the British ancestry point.
Exactly. UK Biobank is fantastic for its scale and the availability of public sex stratified data, which is rare. But it does mean we need follow-up studies to see how well these specific findings translate to other populations and ancestries. That's a crucial next step.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Despite those limitations, what are the future implications? Particularly for things like genetic risk prediction.
Well, it's interesting. The study notes that simply building polygenic risk scores based on sex-stratified GWAS might not always outperform scores from sex-combined GWAS.
Why not?
Mainly because splitting the sample reduces statistical power. You have smaller sample sizes in the sex-specific analyses. However, the real potential lies in developing approaches that directly model these gene-bisex interactions and the complex polygenic covariance structures between males and females. Methods that explicitly account for these local differences and correlations could potentially improve risk prediction significantly, especially, they suggest, for traits with large genome-wide sex differences already known, like testosterone levels or waist-to-hip ratio. It points towards a more nuanced, sex-aware approach to personalized genetic risk assessment.
So, bringing it all together, what's the main take-home message from this deep dive? For me, it seems to be that sex differences in our traits and diseases aren't just these broad genome-wide patterns. Instead, there's this incredibly rich, localized genetic landscape. Specific regions of our DNA are contributing to sex-specific biology in ways we're only just starting to uncover.
I agree completely. Understanding these local genetic differences, the heritability, the correlations, the effect sizes, and crucially, paying close attention to the scale at which we measure these effects is absolutely vital. It's crucial for unraveling the full, complex picture of how genes interact with sex to shape our health. It really moves us beyond those potentially misleading global averages to a much more precise understanding.
What does this mean for how we think about personalized medicine or even just our individual health profiles down the road? It certainly makes you wonder if our current, often one-size-fits-all approaches, are missing some really crucial pieces of the genetic puzzle, especially when considering sex. Definitely something to mull over. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.